In many ways, the kind of cresting of the climate movement after 2018 with Fridays for Future and so on was a result of this kind of momentum that built around, you know, this whole, I mean, also with the, of course, the special report on 1.5 degrees and so on. One can't deny that they've had a catalyzing effect. But they kind of create this notion of after 1.5 degrees, everything is, you know, either lost or, and that's, of course, not the case. There's everything to fight for after 1.5 degrees as well. I mean, politically, I guess, we see the COP is happening as we speak, the conference of parties, the UN negotiations on climate change in Azerbaijan. And 1.5 is still kind of being held on to, right? If you look at Paris, obviously the next limit is 2 degrees, but yeah, there's no reason to, you know, think that after 1.5, we just have to accept that 0.5 degree. Many people say every tenth of a degree matters, and in many ways, of course, it does. And this is also what the special report by the IPCC very clearly showed, right, after in 2018, that, you know, 1.5 was important because the difference between 1.5 and, for example, 2 degree is very, very significant in terms of extreme weather events. And now we also know increasingly the risk of tipping points, you know, the AMOC, for example, or, you know, the Amazon rainforest potentially reaching a point of collapse. It's not a cliff that you kind of fall off of as you cross it.
Alex will be right back with more on the myth of overshoot.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to Dr. Wim Cardin on the dangerous myth of climate overshoot.
There must be supporters of overshoot. Who benefits if climate agreements depend on overshoot and governments go along with that?
I mean, the very clear answer is that the Saudi Arabias of this world and the, everybody who has stakes in continuing to extract oil and gas a little longer, those are the clearest beneficiaries, I would say. Because, you know, the more we think that overshoot is the pathway that is going to bring us there, the more that we postpone phasing out of fossil fuels into the future, the more profit they can make in the meantime, of course. So they are the main people benefiting. And then, you know, the political class that is tied to that in many ways, in the case of Saudi Arabia very directly, but of course, even in a country here like Sweden, you know, there's a lot at stake when it comes to these very rapid decarbonization pathways. They're very unpopular, particularly by politicians on the right hand of the political spectrum, of course. They benefit from this as well.
Yes, you don't have to tell your voters that they're going to have to really cut back on fossil fuels because we'll fix it later. And that is almost the nature of politics, is to say we'll fix it later if they can. There is a growing chorus questioning overshoot, though. Wim, did you see the new paper in Nature led by Carl Friedrich Schleusner? It's titled Overconfidence in Climate Overshoot. Does that fit in with your work?
It really does, yeah. I mean, and this is actually this is a big part of it that we don't touch on in this book, but that we will have a lot to say about in the next book, and that's the whole question of tipping points, of course. And, I mean, what this new paper does is it shows very clearly that, I mean, firstly, you know, there's no guarantee that once we cross 1.5 degree or whatever limit we set, that we will be able to come back. There might be feedbacks or mechanisms being set in motion that mean that the climate system kind of takes on a different dynamic that means it becomes very difficult to kind of wind temperatures back again. That's one risk. I think the broader issue here is that whatever happens once we cross 1.5 degrees and in a potential scenario where we suck CO2 out of the atmosphere and lower temperatures again, maybe on a global average, that's going to be kind of a similar world in terms of, you know, temperatures, but regionally and in terms of ecosystem impact, it's very different, of course. I mean, you might have had species going extinct, all kinds of things will have happened. So the world will look very different. So the two are not the same. And the second part is that, you know, these technologies, carbon dioxide removal, which we would have to rely on to be able to bring us back after overshoot, they are, as I already said, you know, there's a lot of problems with them, but also, I mean, the scale at which we would need to do this raises a whole lot of questions, and so there's really a lot of skepticism within the scientific literature about the ability or even the desirability of doing this at the, you know, very large scale.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest from Lund University, Dr. Wim Carton. We are talking about the myth of overshoot and return in world climate. In your book, Overshoot, you and Andreas work through many lives of it, from economics through possible manipulation of the public. Did you consider the psychology behind such a dangerous giant mass delusion?
Not explicitly, but there's been, this is maybe there's a gap there. There's a bit more on this also in this second book where we go a bit into kind of psychoanalysis because, and we set this up a little bit, right? We talk about this kind of madness. I mean, it's hard to understand this continued move towards what becomes every day more clear is a very dangerous world and a very dangerous future. In purely, you know, economic analysis, for example, which is what the kind of theoretical framework which we use in the book. So you almost need psychology to help us understand this, yeah, as you say, mass delusion.
Well, I just wanted to suggest you could add a religious angle to overshoot because religion builds on the human ability to believe in things that may or may not exist without proof. You do call fossil fuels a demon. And just for fun, I asked an AI, what do demons intend? And it listed five characteristics, and they're so spot on. I want to quickly read them to you. The first is temptation, leading humans into sinful behavior or away from virtuous paths. Possession, taking control of a human body or mind to cause harm or chaos. Deception, spreading lies or falsehoods to confuse people. Corruption, influencing individuals to engage in immoral or unethical actions. And finally, infliction of suffering causing physical, emotional, or spiritual pain to individuals. That sure sounds like fossil fuel addiction to me. What about you? Is it a demon?
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's spot on. That's a very sound analysis, I would say.
So, again, in ancient Greece, when they had a messy ending for a play, the only way they could resolve it was with a god. So they dropped a god or goddess figure onto the stage, maybe with a crane of some sort. And that's the origin of the expression Deus ex machina, God from the machine. And that is kind of how I see overshoot. It's like a contrivance to save us that may or may not exist. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it is, and it may be, I mean, it goes for overshoot as such, and even, you know, for these carbon removal technologies, maybe most of all for this notion of solar geoengineering, which is also attached to this whole idea of overshoot. I mean, so the idea is that, you know, while we work our way across and then back from these temperature limits, we will somehow use a sulfuric shield in the sky to kind of temporarily dampen temperatures, and this will somehow you know, help us maintain a livable climate while we suck the CO2 out of the air. And this is being discussed increasingly. There's a lot of, you know, political interest building in solar geoengineering, actually concerning a lot of philanthropic and private capital flowing into research on this. And there, I think we have a god from the machine, if ever there was one, because yeah, there's a lot to say about that technology.
And suppose we give up the idea of overshoot. Where does that leave us and when it comes to life-saving climate action and carbon reductions?
I mean, I think it just, you know, brings home this absolute necessity of, I mean, we talk about asset stranding in this book, right? This need to grapple with this enormous amount of fossil fuel capital that is fixed in infrastructure and, you know, in cars and everything. And we need a political program to be basically strand that in a way that is not socially destructive. And that's the kind of main thing. It's a very, very big task, of course. But it all comes down to, and this is the struggle that we continue to see at the UN negotiations and everywhere, right, that we need to move the message away from dealing with emissions and so on, to phasing out fossil fuels as soon and as rapidly as possible, because all of these kind of end-of-pipeline solutions come with so many uncertainties and risks and, you know, for misuse, that the simplest and, of course, the most politically unattractive solution as well is to just, you know, get rid of these fossil fuels. Now, I mean, I do want to say, so Andrea and me are not against kind of trying to use. So, I mean, the moment we have managed to do this and we have, you know, stranded the fossil fuel assets that need to be stranded, and we have won the battle on mitigation, and, you know, we're well on our way down to zero emissions, you know, we're not against exploring the idea of some kind of carbon removal solution. I mean, some exist, they have problems, but if we manage to kind of minimize them, there's, of course, no reason not to explore them at a later point. It's just that at this moment in time, the function that they fulfill is the one that we explore in the book, and that is this kind of fantastical kind of, we can continue to do whatever we're already doing because we have these alternatives. So we need to, I think, distinguish between the use of these technologies at different moments in time. In a utopian future, you know, there might be a use for them, but we're just very far away from that at the moment, and therefore something else needs to happen first.
Now, a couple of chapters in your new book cover rapid-fire climate disasters that are developing all over the world in the 2020s, and they come so fast, nobody can know about them all, and then we forget when the next one comes. And that sad list continues to accumulate in 2024. Why include that in a book about overshoot?
I mean, we struggled a little bit with this because, as you say, there's no end to this, right? One of the challenges with writing a climate book, when, you know, publications happen a year after we actually finished writing it. So, I mean, so much has happened in this last year, including, as you have said, you know, all of these more than 1.5 degree record temperatures globally, inevitably setting yourself up for having a very outdated list of disasters. I think we see somehow a normalization or even a numbing toward these disasters. And it's very easy, if you read the mainstream media, to not be confronted with them anymore because, you know, especially with it happening in the global south, often, you know, they're not being reported on. I think people just need to be reminded that this is our everyday reality already now. This is not something that is, you know, going to happen in some kind of distant future. Climate disasters are here, and they're already affecting a whole lot of people. So that's the main reason why we really, you know, wanted to put this front and center. This is ultimately why it matters, right? People's lives are at stake. People's livelihoods are at stake. And I think we need to keep that in mind with everything that we do when it comes to climate.
Yes, there were four typhoons hit the Philippines in the last 2 weeks, and that didn't even make it into the news around here. You wouldn't know it. So then you and Andreas explore a kind of last-ditch, tiny drop of hope. Maybe a great breakdown will open a door to real and necessary changes. I kind of went into this in a 2016 show that I called Can We Count on Catastrophe? And my guests there warned breakdowns don't always lead to a new dawn at all. Talk to us about your considerations about finding hope in crisis.
That's a very good point, and it's something that we've really talked a lot about. We just felt that at a certain point, you know, one has to think, okay, what would the alternative actually be? If we take this kind of asset stranding strategy seriously, it would entail some kind of massive breakdown. We see very often that in times of crisis, there's a moment opening up for what you could call a social tipping point, something happening very rapidly. Those are moments in which, you know, real change can actually occur. And the right have, you know, very often been very successful at kind of utilizing these, right, at what Naomi Klein calls the kind of shock doctrine. But there is absolutely, as you say, no guarantee that, you know, in a moment of crisis, especially not if you, you know, try to trigger it, you can control what happens next and that, you know, the outcome will be in any way desirable. It is maybe even likely that the opposite would happen. I mean, we acknowledge very clearly in the book that we don't have any kind of recipes for what to do. It's obvious that this kind of lightning bolt strategy is a kind of last-ditch attempt. I mean, for 1.5 degrees, as you already mentioned, it's maybe already too late. It's very hard to see what the alternative is, because the amount of capital invested, I mean, the amount of money flowing into fossil fuels is still growing. If you want to put a stop to that, you just need something very different from what is happening at the moment. The way we see it, a crisis is the only thing that could potentially deliver that.
As we wrap up our time here together, would you take a couple of minutes to tell us about your new book in the series, The Long Heat, Climate Politics When It's Too Late?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a book that basically really follows up from Overshoot. And it two things. I mean, firstly, as I already mentioned, it kind of tries to explore the notion of reversibility. So as was indicated, for example, in that Nature study, right? Can we actually, once we cross 1.5 or whatever limit, can we actually come back to that temperature again? Is that possible within the current climate system? So we delve into that quite a lot and explore that. And secondly, we go into a lot of depth when it comes to these technologies for sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere. So we look at all of them and explore, you know, how are they currently being used? What is their potential? What are their drawbacks? And might there be some kind of progressive potential from them? And what we find very clearly is that, I mean, there's so many ways in which they're all being mobilized to, instead of, you know, sucking CO2 down permanently, to generate profit, either by, as I already said, enhancing oil recovery or, you know, being used as offset, or, you know, to make synthetic fuels with the carbon that is being captured, or some other commodities. So we talk about these three front lines. We say that after mitigation, after overshoot, the front lines of climate change are multiplying, and we will not have to struggle over only mitigation, but also adaptation, carbon removal, and geoengineering. And so we map what those struggles essentially will entail about, you know, how do we use these technologies, how are they going to be used by the people in power, and what indications are there already of it happening. That's what this second book is about.
From the University of Lund in Sweden, we've been speaking with Dr. Wim Carton. With Andreas Malm, he has just released the new book, Overshoot, How the World Surrendered to Climate Breakdown. This is not a narrow book for policy wonks. Our future is on the line. Find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Wim, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
The White House has become the East Coast branch office of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal, and climate change has become the preeminent case study of the contamination of our political process by money.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Ross Gelbspan. He passed away in January 2024, but his speech at MIT, November 19, 2006, nailed where we are right now. Here are a couple of clips from the event, Straddling Solutions and Survivalism, presented by Massachusetts Climate Action Network.
Ross Gelbspan, a seasoned investigative reporter, a tough thinker, and a scary truth teller. For 31 years, Ross Gelbspan was an investigative reporter and editor for the Philadelphia Bulletin, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe. His work led to a Pulitzer Prize. Retiring in 1998, he wrote the book The Heat Is On, The Climate Crisis, The Cover-Up, The Prescription. President Clinton read it. His 2004 book is Boiling Point, reviewed in the New York Times by Al Gore. His latest speech was organized by Mark Breslow of the Mass Climate Action Network. The topic is Straddling Between Solutions and Survivalism. Getting published on global warming has been a challenge for even top-named reporters like Ross Gelbspan. He explains the huge gulf in media and public awareness between America and other parts of the world, particularly Europe. Other governments and publics have long recognized the dangers of climate change.
This barrier to information in America has become a fixation for Gelbspan. He has taken a lead in exposing the corruption of the public mind, oiled by millions in propaganda dollars from the fossil fuel industry. He says the major media outlets are blinkered, seeing politics in everything, so they fail to cover issues outside the political sphere, like science, for example. Facts are not political.
The White House has become the East Coast branch office of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal, and climate change has become the preeminent case study of the contamination of our political process by money. This fusion of corporate interests and government power has proved an almost insurmountable obstacle to the climate movement's ability to get its larger message across. So I think a really critical focus for climate activists should be on the press. And I know from my own experience that when the press covers an issue thoroughly and consistently, the public responds, laws get passed. I think in this case it would mobilize the public in 6 months. Unfortunately, the industry public relations specialists have been so successful in promoting equivocal and confusing climate coverage that the American public is about 10 years behind the rest of the world in this area. There are a number of reasons for this, none of them really justifiable. Let me just go through one of scores of these reasons for why the press behaves the way it does. One reason, I think, is the fact that the career path at the top of news outlets normally lies in following the track of political reporting. Top editors tend to see all issues through a political lens. Early in his administration, and this is one example, President Bush declared he would not accept the findings of the IPCC because they represent foreign science, even though half the scientists who contribute to the IPCC are American scientists. Instead, Bush called on the U.S. National Academy of Sciences to provide American science. What I found astounding was this. Even as the Washington Press Corps reported the story, not one reporter that I saw bothered to check the position of the NAS. Had they done so, they would have found that as early as 1992, 3 years before the IPCC declared that we are changing the climate, the NAS was pushing for strong measures to minimize the impacts of human-induced global warming.
Some of Gelbspan's most famous reporting exposed the links between fossil fuel corporations and a handful of paid scientists who implanted the impression of a debate within science about the human role in climate change. But there was no debate in scientific journals or among thousands of experts in the field. Gelbspan compared this effort to cloud our thinking to the public relations efforts of the tobacco lobby, who found experts to deny that smoking caused cancer. History may find the Exxon and Peabody lobbyists help kill more people than the tobacco industry as climate change unfolds in floods, heat waves, droughts, and storms. Some have argued that the foundation of newspaper sales and television viewers is controversy and conflict. So the media simply fell into their old model to sell the fake climate controversy supplied by public relations companies and their paid hack experts. Gelbspan, who knows the media industry as well as anyone, doesn't let the press off so easily. He says irreparable damage has been done to the planet while valuable years were wasted in denial, led by the mainstream media. As he digs away at the black dollars that bought time for ever-growing and excessive profits for the fossil fuel industry, Ross finds the media as guilty as the carbon kings. Let's listen to a few clips from his recent speech, starting with the fake debate.
The next reason has to do with this campaign of disinformation launched by the coal industry and carried forward by ExxonMobil. As I mentioned, the fossil fuel lobby paid a tiny handful of scientists to dismiss the reality of climate change. That campaign has had a profoundly corrosive effect on journalists by insisting this issue of climate change be cast as a debate, when in fact there is no debate whatsoever in the community of mainstream scientists. When it's a story involving opinion, a journalist is ethically obligated to give the major competing points of view their best shot, their about equal space, and their most articulate presentation. But when it's a question of fact, it's up to a reporter to get off his or her butt and find out what the facts are. In this case, we know what the facts are.
Reporters and editors, Gelbspan says, have broken the public trust on the environment story. As his speech develops, Gelbspan seems to say the public might be panicked if it knew the true extent of damage already done to the climate.
As one co-chair of the IPCC said to me, there is no debate among any statured scientists working on this issue about the larger trends of what is happening to the climate. That is something you would never know from American press coverage. But it is something you should point out to every editor and reporter you encounter as you work to get your message out. Stop approaching reporters like beggars asking for a handout. Let them know how angry you are at them for allowing themselves to be conned into betraying their public trust. One researcher who surveyed more than 300 peer-reviewed research articles a couple of years ago found that not one questioned the larger consensus about human-induced warming. By contrast, much of the coverage in the U.S. continues to cast this issue as a debate, and that's exactly what the public relations specialists of big coal and big oil want. They don't care who wins the debate, as long as the public perceives it to be a debate. And that way, people can shrug their shoulders and walk away and say, come back and tell us what you know when you really know what you're talking about. To keep the issue framed as a debate allows the public to avoid confronting what can be a frightening and potentially emotionally overwhelming threat.
Gelbspan was asked to leave the audience with a note of optimism, but he changed his title to reflect the divided feelings many in the field hold. His new title, Straddling Between Solutions and Survivalism. I think we're going to need both, ways to survive a very bumpy transition to a carbonless, sustainable economy, even while we implement the solutions that will save future generations from hell on earth. We're going to get some of both, folks. There is a whole chorus of people, from net bloggers to senior scientists, who are thinking about survivalism if we can't adapt our political and economic systems soon enough. Things may fall apart.
Because of the success of this deeply dishonest campaign of information control, we find ourselves today in a sort of schizophrenic predicament. We are torn between the promise of solutions and the impulse towards survivalism. The situation is that dire. How are people of goodwill and social conscience supposed to respond in the face of a coming age of collapse? There is no body of expertise, no authoritative answers for this one. We are standing at the threshold of uncharted territory, and since there's no precedent to guide us, we are left with only our own hearts to consult, our intellectual integrity to look reality in the eye, whatever courage we can muster, and our uncompromising dedication to a human future that reflects the combined aspiration of every person in this room. So thank you all so much.
Find my full program on Ross Gelbspan's MIT speech in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Tune in next week for more Climate Voices the Mainstream Misses. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. We go out with my new song from the sea. It is a kind of green love song. Grab it free from my website, ecoshock.org.
listening to